everyone. Welcome to Thomas and the Bible, the podcast where I take on the entire Bible in all its infinite foolishness. So today we're going to start on Genesis chapter 11. And it's pretty cool book, pretty cool chapter. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Yeah, that pretty much verifies what we know of history. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Oh, by the way, I don't know how to pronounce anything in this book, so I'm just making it up. And if it's wrong, I really don't care. Anything I could think of would be better use of time than learning how to pronounce things in this book. Anyway, and they said one to another, Go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. Okay, so we got a bit of a dilemma here, I think, for anyone trying to maintain that this God represented here is all-powerful. Well, besides the obvious things where, you know, obviously should have seen this coming, blah, 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 that stuff. That's obvious, but still, that doesn't make it any less meaningful. It's just that I'm not going to say that over and over, although I might mention a little bit. But, so what's going on here? They have these people, everyone in the earth speaks the same language, and they're all organized under one name, lest they be scattered. And so they decide, like you would, you decide to build a tower that's going to reach to heaven, because they're like, you know, screw this, let's go visit God. So the problem I have is this. God actually gets worried about this. He's actually like somewhat concerned, like, oh, what's that they're doing down there? Are they going to... Wait, what's that? They're going to build a tower to reach the heavens? Uh-oh. I better do something about this. You know, and instead of... first of all, this idea that they're going to reach to the heavens. They're going to build a tower. Now, people didn't know that the earth revolved around the sun. But... God did, right? Or did he not? Did he make that discovery like the same time as us? See, because God, you know, he would have looked at him, he would have saw that tower and be like, first of all, that doesn't even matter. He would have said, oh, okay, they'll get about, you know, yay high, 200 feet or you know, what, like nothing with that technology. I don't know how high you can build a tower with brick. I mean, it's not even a concern, obviously. And secondly, even if they could get fairly high, eventually, you know, air pressure and you know, that would probably take care of it pretty quickly. And then even if they could, you know, supposedly build a tower as tall as they even wanted, what direction is heaven? I think there might be an Eddie Izzard bit on this where he's saying that, you know, up is heaven. Unless you're in the southern hemisphere, then you got to pray down through the earth. It's something like that. But anyway, what direction are they going to build this thing in that's going to get them to heaven? Like, wouldn't God? I think what God would probably do is he'd come down and he'd say, "Oh, hey guys, look, yeah, nice tower, but this is a common confusion. Let me just clear this right up for you." The sun doesn't revolve around the earth revolves around the sun. So since it's in motion like that, Well, actually, it's everything, and the sun's in, everything's in motion. There's no way you can build a tower that will get to me. So, yeah, just thought I'd clear that up before you, you know, make fools of yourselves. But, you know, have a good one. See you around. And so that's probably what he'd say. He could have just, see, if there was a God, I think there wouldn't be all these ridiculous scientific inaccuracies. I mean, you sort of say, yeah, well, you know, back then they didn't know. Yeah, they didn't know. But if there was a God, God knew. God knows everything. He shouldn't have had any problem. He could have told us any number of scientific discoveries that we would have made. And by the way, if they were in this book and had been printed, you know, 2,000 years ago or whatever it is, then we'd be, there'd be a different story. You know, there'd be a reason to sort of look at this thing and think, maybe something's going on here. There's all these bits of knowledge. But no, it's clear that it was just written by stupid people. So anyway, I also found this commentary by Adam Clark, and I looked into it a little bit. I guess he's a Methodist, which I don't. I'm pretty ignorant of all the little different sects and viewpoints and all that on religion. But he wrote the most exhaustive commentary on the Bible. It sounds like he had even more time to waste than I do, apparently, because it took him like 40 years or something, which really depresses the crap out of me that someone spent that much time poring over this retarded book with the assumption that it was true. So he's finding all these little ways to justify things that happen in it. And he said that, I think he said someone else wrote this or some other people believe this, but he said, well, it wasn't really, the translation is wrong. It's not really a tower to go to heaven. It's just a tower that sort of looks to the heavens. And so they were going to, you know, they're just building it to worship God with or whatever. And so my response to that would be then, okay, then why did God have such a problem with that he had to confound their language? And then I read a little bit more down and it said, well, this was a problem probably because it's sort of idolatry, and that's definitely not, you know, that's not going to fly with God. He doesn't like idolatry. Then I thought about that. I was like, oh, okay, I guess that almost makes sense. But then I thought a little more, and I thought, well, if he's worried about people committing idolatry, then what? Why the weird-ass roundabout way of getting him to stop? You know, like, if that was his prime concern, like, oh, man, they really want to, you know, they're going to build this tower and worship it instead of me. I know, I'll confuse them so that they can't really build the tower. Is that really the best way to deal with that problem? Like, is that what anyone would do? That didn't really take away the desire that they have for some reason or another. Maybe because, well, God created us, so he should know. But it doesn't really deal with the issue at hand. Just sort of confuses us until, you know, maybe they grow to the point where a population of them speaks the same language that would be bigger than the population we were just talking about. And then they'd have the same problem. So that's ridiculous, and it's obviously the nut jobs who made this up thought, wait, if, you know, this is how it was created, then why do we have all these different languages? So they said, oh, I got it. Perfect explanation right here. So it's just shameless fabrication, I guess. So that's, this chapter goes on just talking about the generations of Shem. Shem begat people, Arphaxad, they live, it's weird, they sort of alternate, like some of them live like 400 years and the next guy lives 30 years and 70 years. I guess they could have died of some weird causes, but it's sort of funny that I would have been like, ah, dude, God, WTF, God, my father lived to be 430 and I'm dying at the age of 70. Are you kidding me? I would have been a little upset at that. So yeah, that goes all the way to the end. And then, okay, Haran. So we're down in generations a bit. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife, Milcah. the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, alas. I added the alas. Sometimes I add in these little one or two word things. I wonder if it doesn't really play and you just sort of think it's part of the Bible. It's probably true. I promise I didn't write this, though. I swear I did not write this retarded book. I don't know how I can convince you of that, but no, I'm not making up what I'm reading right now, for the most part. I add a word every now and then. She had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son, Abram's wife. I don't really care. This, you know, back when they didn't have soap operas, I guess this is all they could do. It's just like, oh, so did you hear about Terah and Abram? How they begat, you know, Nahor? You know, it's like, I guess that's all they had to do is just document these series of begatting. And they came into Haran, dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205, and Terah died in Haran, in case you were wondering. So that's it for chapter 11. Oh, just another quick bit about the Adam Clark thing, the commentary. He also wrote, like, so the first language must have obviously been Hebrew, because that's the language that God spoke unto the people. So, doing that little bit of math, he made the brilliant discovery that Hebrew, well, he didn't discover it, but he made the statement that Hebrew must have been the first language on earth. But I guess we can just go ahead and ignore, I looked it up, and Sumerian and Egyptian are actually the oldest documented languages, at least written languages, that predate this by quite a bit. So we can just go ahead and ignore that, because our Bible tells us to, and the Bible is never wrong. So that's chapter 11. And now we have chapter 12. I'm going to try to get through this one a little faster to reduce the time here. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, into a land that I will shew thee. S-H-E-W, thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. So what did Abram do to deserve? Is he that? I don't know. I skipped through the generations, but there wasn't any in the last chapter, but there wasn't any substance. I don't think he did anything, you know, to necessarily deserve being... Like God singles him out of, there's probably a considerable amount of people on the earth now. And yet he's singled out. I don't know. Maybe we'll find out later he has some virtue or something. I don't know. But could he really have been that much better than everybody else on the earth that he's going to bless him and curse him that curseth thee and all that? So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went, he has like a bag of souls, I guess. Sounds like a World of Warcraft thing or something. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. And into the land of Canaan they came. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, unto the plain of Moreh. And the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed I will give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. So they come into this land that's somebody else's, named Canaan. He's long dead. So the Canaanites. And he says, no, stop here. This is good. I'll just get all these people out of here. Get them out. Kick them out. And this can be your land. They'll just have to find a new place. I think it might go back to when Noah cursed Canaan, son of Ham, I think it was. Does it come back to that, maybe? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out later or something. But again, what did Abram do that was so much better than Canaan? Anyway, and he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east, and there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass that when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai his wife, "Behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee." I like that. So I think... So it was probably like, okay, Sarai. Now, if I say I'm your husband, they might kill me and take you as their wife. But if you say that I'm your brother, then you know they'll probably just they'll just rape you or whatever, do whatever they want or something like that. But anyway, I'll be fine. And Sarai says, does Sarai say anything in this scene? I don't know if there's been evidence that a woman actually has talked yet. No, I do remember Eve saying like one or two things, but beyond that, I don't think a woman has yet to say anything in the Bible. But anyway, Sarai says, "I don't know about this plan. I'm a little worried." And Abram says, "No, I'll be fine. Just say I'm your brother. I'll be fine." Yeah. So that's what she did. She probably doesn't have a vote in that. Let's find out what happens next. And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commanded her before the Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into the Pharaoh's house. Abram says, "Ah, good, plan worked." And he entreated Abram well for her sake. And he had sheep and oxen, and he asses and manservants and maidservants, and she asses and camels. Oh, so Abram pretty much just traded her to the Pharaoh for all of these oxen, these sheep, which, if you adjust for time, were probably worth millions of dollars by now. Jeez, a sheep back then? Anyway. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And the Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou, 'She is my sister,' so I might not have taken her to be my wife? Now, therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away and his wife and all that he had. So that's the end of the text. So I think what we have here is now it becomes a little more clear. I think it's the world's first con job. I think they're like, okay, we really need some... Gosh, you know, I need some sheep. I need some oxen, asses, men servants, maid servants. We're really low on sheep, oxen, asses, men servants, and maid servant supplies. Okay, here's what we're gonna do. So I got this. Did I tell you God blessed me recently? This is all Abram talking, of course. Did I tell you about that? Yeah, he blessed me. I don't know. I'm not sure what I did, but anyway, he blessed me. And he's going to curse anyone who curses me. So I'm thinking, here's what we should do. We go into Egypt. You're beautiful. We go into Egypt. And I say, "I'm your brother," right? And so I can basically sell you to them and get all this stuff we need. But then the Lord, get this, the Lord is probably going to plague them. Because, you know, I say probably, I figure 80% likelihood. Again, Sarai's like, I don't know. Abram's like, "Listen, you're a woman. You have no right. You're doing, I don't even know why I'm asking. I'm telling you the plan." And so, you know, we'll do that. And the Lord curses them, and then I get you back. And if they, you know, if they violated you, what, you know, whatever. You try to hold them off a little bit, but who cares? So I think that's what happened there is they, so he conned them, you know, sold them damaged, tainted goods. And got it back, got stuff in return. So far from being worthy of praise, it sounds like Abram is sort of cowardly and at least a little shifty. So that's the end of chapter 12. All right, chapter 13. Somewhat uneventful. So that's good. We can make some time here and get through it. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and gold. Well, of course he was. Who knows how many other times he pulled this little con job that the Bible didn't document. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, H-A-I, I don't know, unto the place of the altar which he had make there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. And Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents, flocks of tents, tentsmen, herdsmen, flocksmen. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was too great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. So pretty much there's just no room for anybody anymore. And Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Well, yeah, the whole land would be before you when you know God's just going to sort of, you know, just sort of etch out whoever's living there, just sort of erase them from the land. Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Foreshadowing. Even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. You know, when you comest unto Zoar, how the land's like. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent towards Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked sinners before the Lord exceedingly. What could men from Sodom be doing that is so sinful? Maybe we'll find out about that later. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, Lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. One of these cardinal directions will not make it through this class. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. And Abram said, Lord, I don't know if I'm exactly equipped to hold seed that numbers as the dust of the earth. I don't know if I can sort of hold all that. Lord said, no, idiot, I'm just talking about down through the years, this seed going, okay, gotcha. Cool. Arise, walk through the land, in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abram removed his tent, and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron. If you take the 5 down from Mamre, it goes right through Hebron. And built there an altar unto the Lord. He builds a lot of altars. Jeez. You'd think you just build like a traveling altar, you know? It has like a thermos and like it just so that he doesn't have to build one every time he stops. So that's the end of chapter 13 already. And now I just want to talk about a little... I'm sort of reading this Adam Clark commentary. It gives me a little more material. And I don't really know. This is the first I've heard of it, so I don't know if it's something... all religious people or any religious, I don't know, it's something people still read, but it just sort of represents what deep thought about the Bible really is like. So I like this little ditty he has here. It is very likely that the angel of the covenant appeared to Abram in open day when he could have taken a distinct view of the length and breadth of this good land. The revelation made in chapter 5 was evidently made in the night, for then he was called to number the stars, which could not be seen but in the night season. Here he is also called on to number the dust of the earth, which could not be seen but in the daylight. So I like this. He's sort of carving out this little bit of logic here. Obviously, it's very likely that the angel appeared in open day this time, because he had to be able to count the sand, which you can't see the sand in the daylight or in the nighttime, duh. and the same logic applies before when he was called to number the stars. Obviously, this angel came at the night because you can't see the stars in the day. I just love this look, like how. Why? What is the point of writing that? Like, first of all, if the Lord says stars, I think you sort of know. Like, did he not? Was that the first time Abram? Lord says, yeah, as the stars. Abram says stars. Lord says, no, look up. What? Look up. Yeah, look up. Oh, holy crap, there's a lot of those bright little... So those are stars. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's a lot. Well, not quite as many as I thought, but... Yeah, so that's... So he couldn't just say stars and no. But and also sand. It's one thing if you never, looked up at the stars, but, like, sand? it is... ridiculous either way, but then notwithstanding, I love just trying to assign this little teeny bit of logic, just trying to sandwich this in there to this Bible passage. Like, look, I've had this thought about this passage. It must have been during the day because anyway, ridiculous. On to chapter 14. Okie dokie, chapter 14. This one makes a better movie than it does a book, but I'll try to read it, and if I had sound effects, I would use them. But let's see. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elisar. Oh, Elisar. It's from Lord of the Rings. This is going to be a terrible chapter. There's a bunch of names and stuff. Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, of whom Jason Elam is the only living descendant, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shember, king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the vale of the Siddim, which is the Salt Sea, as opposed to the freshwater seas. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year came Chedorlaomer, we'll just call him C, and the kings that were with him, and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, and the Zuzims in Ham, and the Ammons in Shavan-Kariathem. And if you're following this, then you're doing better than I am, and I've read through it a few times. It's just basically five kings versus four kings, or four total of nine kings. They fought somebody. I don't really know what it has to do with anything, but it'll get to it. And the Horites and their Mount Seir unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to Enmishpat, which is Kadesh. It's weird not understanding. And came to Enmishpat, which is Kadesh. Oh, okay. Because if I didn't recognize Enmishpat, but then when he said that it's Kadesh, then that made sense. And smote all the country of the Amalekites. No, just smote the entire country of the Amalekites. That's not very nice. And also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazazontamar. And there went out the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboiim. And the king, this is getting to be like a Dr. Seuss book. And they joined battle with him in the Vale of Siddim, with C, the king of Elam, and the Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elisar, four kings with five. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, all their victuals, and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother. Uh-oh. Abram's going to tell God. Tell God on you, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods. Also, that's sort of curious. They specifically targeted Lot, like they just took Lot, like they were all in Sodom. They're like, not you, not you, not you. Ah, you. I'm taking you and all your goods. I don't know. It seems kind of random, but maybe they took lots of people. I don't know. Just only mentions Lot. And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of, I don't really care who his siblings are. And these were confederate with Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants. They probably had to have like a training montage too. Born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus, if you're counting. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his good. Oh, yeah, okay. So this is maybe, verse 16 here is probably the weirdest phrasing I've ever heard. Listen to this. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. So he brought back all the goods, but he also brought Lot's goods, just in case you were wondering if that was included in all the goods. And he brought the women, but he also brought the people. So women, I guess, don't count as people. I guess that, yeah, could be a translation thing, but it's just such a weird phrase. Moving on. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Si, and of the kings that were with him, at the valley of Sheveh, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, Oregon, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. Huh. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heavens and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand." And he gave him tithes of all. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, "Give me the persons, and take the goods to thyself." And Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and a portion of the men that went with me, and Eshcol and Mamre, let them take their portion." And that's the end of a really odd chapter 14. Just basically a battle, and then they take Lot, and so Abram gets together his people and goes and fights whoever that is that had him, whatever weird, oddly named king had him, and gets Lot back. And so then Sodom says, "Take everything," and Abram says, "No, I'm not going to take anything because I have too much pride." So, not a lot to really talk about in this. It's really descriptive of some weird events, except that I think, based on Adam Clark's commentary, again, he's sort of complimenting how brave Abram is for going to war with only 318 against, I don't know, like thousands, I guess, or can't be that many. But he says, but Abram did have God on his side. So I like that. Abram's personally in communication with God, right? And I like how, like, he's a little nervous, too. There's a line that says he divided himself. Basically, it says, you know, he had to, like, get his courage together, sort of, to go do it. And I like that, like, yeah, you have God on your side, but still, 318. It should be a war where you have God on your side, like a God you're talking to, an all-powerful God, that should basically consist of you going over and informing the other side that you won. Like, that should be, it could be, why did Abram even need the 318 people? He has God. He should have just been like, you know, he sort of walks over, everybody's on their army. Maybe they have horses or whatever. I don't know how armies were back then, but goes over. Hey guys, how's it going? Yeah, yeah, cool army. See, you got lots of guys there. That's cute. By the way, I have this all powerful god I talk to that's on my side, and he's pretty much has decided that I won. So we can do this whole fight thing. You know, lots of people can be killed, or you could just give up. I didn't even bother. I mean, I kind of have an army, but, you know, they're eating right now, and I don't really want to, you know, do we have to do this? I mean, come on. Or actually, you know what? Maybe Abram just went, what Abram probably did is he just had each member of the opposing army try to have sex with his wife. And then God, like in the previous, you know, that's his go-to scheme that he runs. And then God just cursed him that way. That might have been how they did it. Either way, I don't really see what the point of a war is when you have a god. You could just say, I win. So let's go on to chapter 15, see what happens there. Okay. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, Behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in mine house is mine heir. If you remember, Abram's wife Sarai is barren, so he has no son. And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, This shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth, referring to the nephew that was living with him. But he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir. Ugh. So he's going to shit out an heir? How does that work? Ugh. Man, that must have been one stinky heir. And he brought him forth abroad and said, Look now toward heaven, and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, So shall thy seed be. And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it. I wonder, does that count stars in our galaxy or all galaxies? Because that could make a pretty significant difference in the number of seed. Because, I mean, eventually it'll run out. So, like, does the covenant end at that point? Like, okay, if it's all the stars in our galaxy, I think there's something like 100 billion stars per galaxy. I mean, you know, there's 6 billion people, 6.5 billion people now. I could see not that long in the future we go through 100 billion people that are his heirs. Well, we've already gone through quite a few, so does it just end? I wonder, like, how much would that suck to be, like, the son of the 100 billionth person, you know? Be like, hey, I'm here, we have a covenant, right? God, huh? God's like, oh, sorry. Just ran out of covenant. Fresh out. This is all nonsense. Anyway. And he brought him forth abroad and said, Look now toward heaven and tell... I read that. And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. And he said unto him, I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees. You know, another thought. Back then, they didn't know that there were 100 billion stars. There must have been far fewer visible stars. Anyway, to give thee this land and inherit it. And he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And he said unto him, Take me an heifer of 3 years old, that's some sort of animal, and she a goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a partridge and a pear tree. No, and a young pigeon. And he took unto him all these, and he divided them in the midst, and laid each one against another, but birds divided he not. Okay, I think I'm on to something here. Okay, bear with me. I think that God is actually just a junkie for animal sacrifice. I think he needs his fit. Like, why does an all-powerful God need you to sacrifice a goat, a ram, a pigeon, and a turtle dove? Like, that's crucial to the God recipe or something. I think he's a junkie. I think he's like, okay, I'll give you what, Abram, what do you want? I'll give you a son. I'll give you a seed, and that's where that exaggeration comes from. I'll give you more seed than all the stars in the entire world. Just give me, okay, just do this one thing for me. All you gotta do, just get me, oh God, just get me a goat, a heifer, a ram, a turtle dove, oh, and a young pigeon. Yeah. Get that all. Get them all. Get them now. And just burn them and let me smell them. Yeah, do that. I'll give you whatever you want. Whatever you want. Whatever war, whatever battle, I'll be with you. Anything. I think that's what's going on here. Let's look out for that in the future. And when the fowls came upon the carcasses, Adam drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that it's not theirs. That's kind of an important line. And shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge. And afterward they shall come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Cadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Stalactites and the Stalagmites and the Rephaims and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. So that's the end of that chapter. Not too terribly interesting, but we did reveal that crucial piece of information about God. I think he has a problem. I think we may have to have an intervention sometime here. On to chapter 16. All right, things get a little steamy in this chapter. Chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had an handmaid, an Egyptian whose name was Hagar, and she was horrible. No. And Sarai said unto Abram, Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid, It may be that I may obtain children by her. That's some good language right there. Oh man. So I love how it's direct, but it's also pretty casual too. It doesn't say, look, why don't you just, sleep with my maid and whatever. It says, I pray thee, go in unto my maid like hey, Abram. Yeah, are you doing anything today? Going to the post office? No, nothing. I was just wondering, I don't know, could you go in under my maid, and if there's any children there that to be begotten, maybe you could, grab a few or whatever? You don't have to. Dumb idea. Never mind. Oh, will you? Okay. It's such a nice way to say it. And this is good. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. Yeah. Because he's doing that. He's doing that because it's listening to his wife. That's why he's doing that, obviously. Yeah. Hey, can you have sex with my maid? Well, I don't want to disobey you. And you've pretty much, my hands are tied, I guess. I guess. Weird. Okay, so anyway, where's she? Over there? All right. Be back in a minute. Yeah. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. Maybe she wrapped her up in a bow like those the Lexus commercials, the big red bow. That'd be kind of funny. Oh, wait, there wasn't any Christmas back then, I guess. Boy, what did they do? Man, the retail industry must have sucked back then. Anyway, and he went in unto Hagar. God, I love that phrase. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. You know, another thought. What if, like, what if Sarai actually didn't mean have sex? Abram goes, okay, well, we did it. She did what? Well, we did it, and she's pregnant now. What? Well, like you said, I went in unto her, like you wanted, and she's pregnant now. No. You bastard. I didn't mean have sex with her. I meant in vitro or something. There's got to be some, you know, like just grab an egg or two. I know that's not invented yet, but bear with me. What if she didn't actually mean? The language is so weird. I wouldn't be surprised. Go in unto my maid. Whoops. Bumped the mic there. Anyway, and Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thine hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. That's a weird... I like that phrase, but maybe that's where get out of my face sort of came from. No, that's pretty literal. Okay, so this is great. So Sarai gets mad because Hagar, the maid, is mad at Sarai now. I guess because Hagar knows like she's going to have a child and Sarai's going to take it. That's probably why she's mad at her. So Sarai, in turn, gets mad at Abram and says, now she's mad at me, I'm a mess, you know, she's all mad. And Abram says, well, she's your handmaid, do whatever you want. And so Sarai beats the crap out of her. And that makes sense. I don't really get that. Anyway, so Hagar leaves because she just got the crap kicked out of her by Sarai, even though she did what she said, like it's Hagar's fault. And the angel of the Lord, there's no justice in this weird biblical world. It's all weird crap. Anyone who thinks we can get morals from the Bible is just nuts. It's just all a bunch of weird garbage. Anyway. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid. In case Hagar didn't do. Hey, Hagar! Hagar, hey, Sarai's maid. Oh, you mean me, the only person here? Yeah. Whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands. And now the Lord's endorsing this garbage. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. So he's going to be wild and gay? And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Again. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, thou God seest me, for she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore the well was called Beer Laharoi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Beret. So they're just sort of clarifying where that well was in case we wanted to go there as a pregnant handmaiden. Wherefore the well was called Beer Laharoi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered, sort of, you know, halfway in between those two towns or something, whatever they are. And Hagar bare Abram a son. And Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old. 86. Wow. When Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. So that's the end of our reading for this podcast. Thank Jehovah. And one last quick thing, the Adam Clark commentary. He says a lot of stuff, but one part in this one is he said, when the angel or whoever it was talked to Hagar at the fountain, Adam Clark says, see, Jesus Christ is already implicated in this. And you keep saying Jesus Christ. I'm reading this. I'm like, well, we're still in the Old Testament, right? Still long before Jesus. But he says it because he's trying to, like, tie Jesus into it. Like, you know, like the whole thing makes sense somehow, you know? So he says that he sets out these five reasons that Jesus must be the one who's been talking to these people. I think every time the Lord sends an angel down, I guess it's supposedly, according to Adam Clark, is Jesus Christ. And he lays out five reasons that are just BS. The reasons are like, well, he's not a person and he knows as much as God knows. So therefore he must be Jesus Christ, since Jesus is God's, you know, is part of God, the Trinity or whatever. That's so basically completely sort of circular argument that just obviously begs the question, you know, just he's doing it to sort of validify the New Testament, but he's arguing for it by referencing the New Testament, like by relying on the New Testament. So it's circular in that way. And I like how if this were really true, if God was really, you know, that, well, if God really existed and the people who wrote this were really divinely inspired, they would have mentioned that. I think that would have been a pretty good, like, you know, that would have had some credit, you know, if hundreds of years before the New Testament, they were writing, and the angel of the Lord, whose name was Jesus and will come into play later, said such and such, you know, like that would have helped the case a little bit, you know? And it's so patently obvious that it's just people trying to grasp at straws and come up with, you know, patterns and ways for this to make sense when it's just a bunch of BS. So that's the end of our reading today. As usual, send all comments to comments@thomasinthebible.com. Questions, comments, death threats, life threats, and junk mail, you know, Viagra ads, anything you want. Send it there and I'll address it maybe on the future podcasts. And thanks a lot for listening. See you next time.